Most people think of Granada as just another postcard paradise, a sleepy speck in the Caribbean known for white sand and nutmeg. But that's only what the brochures want you to see. Beneath the canopy of palm trees lies a volcanic heart still smouldering with stories of revolution, resistance, and rebirth. This is the island where enslaved Africans turned forbidden drumbeats into survival codes, where colonizers' cathedrals now cast shadows over markets selling cassava bread and oil down. It's a place where the scent of turmeric hangs in the air like memory, and where oral traditions carry more weight than any colonial textbook. Granada is not just the Isle of Spice, it's the Island of Sparks. And to explore it properly, you have to taste what the fire left behind. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Roots, Rhythms, and Rebellion. The first thing that hits you in Granada is not the ocean breeze. It's the scent. Spice-laden, earthy, and strangely familiar, like the warm kitchen of an ancestor you've never met. At the St. George's Market Square, beneath the colonial clock tower that has watched centuries tick by, vendors hawk bundles of cinnamon bark, glistening cocoa balls, and pale yellow turmeric roots still caked with soil. Here, even commerce smells like memory. A woman in a wide straw hat crushes nutmeg into a mortar, mixing it into molasses to make nutmeg jam, not for tourists, but for her grandchildren. Behind her, a Rasta vendor waves a bundle of bay leaf at a passing group and declares, "Dis one, dis cure heartache, cold sweat, and wicked dreams." This is Granada in motion, never static, always layered. And like its people, its culture is born from collision. The collision of worlds. Granada was never supposed to be. It was taken, first by the French in 1650, then wrenched from their hands by the British in 1762. What followed was the plantation nightmare, scripted by empire, sugar, slavery, silence. But the Caribs who leapt to their deaths from Leper's Hill in resistance, and the Africans who refused to be erased, made Granada something else, entirely. It became a crucible, not just of rebellion, but of reinvention. Under British rule, Granada became the Spice Island, exporting nutmeg, mace, cinnamon, and cloves. But spices were more than export. They were medicine, prayer, and protest. Women ground turmeric into poultices to heal bruises from overseers' whips. They whispered over simmering pots, mixing not just flavors but secrets. Recipes became resistance manuals. The fusion of African, Kalinago, French, and British traditions gave birth to a new language of survival, a syncretic cultural code hidden in plain sight. Food as code, cuisine as archive. Ask a Grenadian grandmother for her oil-down recipe, and you'll get a glance sharp enough to cut breadfruit. Because oil-down, Granada's national dish isn't just food. It's family, folklore, and fury, cooked into a single bubbling pot. Callaloo, salted meat, turmeric, coconut milk, breadfruit. Each ingredient is a chapter in the island's survival story. Take breadfruit, for example. It was brought to the Caribbean by colonialists trying to feed enslaved laborers on the cheap. But Grenadians didn't just survive on it, they turned it into comfort food. Today, in villages like Guyave, oil down is slow cooked in iron pots over open fire, where neighbors gather not just to eat, but to remember. The preparation is communal, and the telling of history begins before the first flame is lit. Cocoa tea, another seemingly benign drink, is a cultural text, thick, bitter, and spiced. It's made by rolling fermented cocoa into balls, then boiling it with cinnamon, bay leaf, and nutmeg. Unlike commercial hot chocolate, cocoa tea is unapologetically Grenadian, raw, dark, and brewed with centuries of unspoken memory. The spirits that stayed. Christianity may dominate the churches, but older beliefs still live in Grenadian kitchens, gardens, and graveyards. Take the practice of Obeah, a spiritual science feared by colonizers and forbidden under British law. While rarely named openly today, its residues linger in everyday life. You see it in the blue bottles hung over doorways to repel duppies. You hear it in the language, phrases like fixing someone or making a hand allude to ancestral rituals whispered across generations. In villages like Tivoli and Munich, elder women still sweep the yard, with bushes tied from local herbs believed to remove bad spirits and ward off misfortune. These aren't just superstitions, they're survival strategies handed down through oral traditions, especially by women. One 78-year-old woman, Miss Eloise, put it this way. When they take everything from you, your name, your tongue, your God, you don't forget how to boil a bush and talk to your dead. In Grenada, belief is layered. You go to church Sunday morning, then leave a dish of rice under the guava tree that night, just in case. Carnival, rebellion dressed in Maz every August, Grenada's spice moss transforms the island into a technicolor fever dream. Tourists see feathers, rum, and dancing. But for Grenadians, Jab Jab, the devil Maz, is a memory ritual. Men cover themselves in black oil, horns strapped to their heads, chains rattling from their waists. They march through towns at sunrise, shouting, groaning, growling. It's chaos, it's catharsis, it's history embodied. The Jab Jab is a symbolic retelling of enslavement, resistance, and the chaotic freedom that followed emancipation. The black oil mocks colonial fear. The chains clatter with ancestral defiance. One man I spoke with said, "When I play Jab, I's not me no more, is my grandfather, is his grandfather, is fire." Children dance to soca beats, steel pans echo off concrete walls, and masqueraders spin stories with their bodies. The revelry masks a deeper truth, that Grenada's identity is shaped not by submission, but performance, by the act of remembering out loud. From bishop to bombs, political eruptions. Modern Grenadian history carries scars less visible but just as defining. In 1979, Maurice Bishop led a Marxist revolution that toppled the government. His vision, education, healthcare, and anti-imperialism, briefly lit a new path. But in 1983, after the internal conflict, Bishop was executed by hardliners in his own party. Days later, the US invaded under Operation Urgent Fury. For older Grenadians, the revolution is not an open wound, but a buried ember. Some say Bishop betrayed his ideals. Others say he was betrayed. But nearly all agree. He made us dream for a moment. The Flame of Revolution mural in St. George's still burns bright, even as tourists snap selfies in front of it. In Guyave, where Bishop once marched, an elder fisherman named Callist said quietly, "The problem with fire is it don't care who strike the match." To understand Grenada today, you must walk through these dualities. Paradise and pain, hospitality and history, spice and smoke. Language, Creole as code, as weapon, English may be the official language, but Grenadian Creole, the vernacular born from resistance, is the tongue of home. It's musical, economical, and rebellious. To catch you arse means to suffer. To haze up is to rebel. Words are bent, blended, reimagined. Creole isn't just linguistic flair. It's a defiant memory archive, a way of refusing erasure. It survives in calypsos, in scandalous double entendre, in the way a grandmother calls out across the yard. During slavery, Creole helped enslaved people organize uprisings, disguise meaning, and preserve West African syntax under European grammar. Even today, when youth freestyle over dance hall beats in a mixture of patois and English, they are remixing resistance. They are saying, "We are still here, and we still sound like ourselves. The village that watches the sea, in the village of Sauteur, where the wind is always strong and the surf unkind, the land seems to lean toward the ocean like a question. This is where the Caribs made their final stand in 1651, choosing death over subjugation. Today, Lapers Hill is a scenic lookout, but the ground is heavy. Beneath it lie stories that never got to be told. Local school children are taught the legend, but few know the names of the Carib leaders. The French built a chapel where the Caribs leapt, sanctifying the land they stole. But across the road, vendors sell conch shells and guava cheese, laughing in a language the colonizers failed to destroy. A young guide, barefoot and soft-spoken, pointed to the cliff and whispered, "They say, when the sea real calm here, is because the ancestors sleep in. But when it rough, better light a candle and stay inside." In Granada, even the waves remember. Chapter 2. Earth, Women and the Fire That Stays to Know. Granada is to know its women. Not the bronze statues or brochure smiles, but the living, breathing archivists of pain, pleasure, and plant wisdom. Grenadian women are keepers of what was never written down. In their hands, turmeric turns into salve. In their mouths, stories turn into instruction. Across hills and beaches, they're the pulse of the island, steadier than the surf, sharper than a machete. And through them, Grenada continues not just to survive, but to remember how to thrive. Grandmother's Gardens and Grenadian Alchemy. In the steep interior village of Morne Jalou, I met Miss Edna, age 86, barefoot, blind in one eye. She boiled fevergrass on a coal pot in her yard while surrounded by bush medicine, lemongrass, guinea hen weed, cerise vine, and wild basil. "Doctors only know the name," she said. "We know the story of the leaf." Her fingers trembled as she listed remedies. Avocado seed for bellyache, clove oil for toothache, nutmeg for sleep. Her knowledge wasn't scientific. It was sacred. Passed down from her mother, who learned it from an enslaved woman born on the plantation. Every bruise and sickness had an answer in the soil. Even now, neighbors came knocking. The colonial system wrote women like Edna out of its history. But in Granada, they remained unsilenced through ritual, sweeping yard with herb bundles, whispering into boiling pots, using an egg to roll away bad spirits. These rituals are not folklore. They are survival science passed through time as inheritance. The Calypso Oracle. Every carnival season, the soca blares loudest. But the truths arrive quieter, in a tent of elders with microphones and metaphors. Calypso in Granada isn't just music. It's a cultural reckoning. You can say what politicians fear, as long as you rhyme it. In 2004, after Hurricane Ivan devastated the island, destroying 90% of homes, a Calypsonian called Scholar released a song titled A Lesson. In it, he sang, "We worship the moles and forget the land. Ivan, show us where we truly stand." The song became a rallying cry for returning to soil. Across the island, gardens were replanted. Community bush groups were reborn. Women led efforts to reseed abandoned plots. Ivan stripped away roofs, but it also stripped away illusions of modern invincibility. In the Calypso tents, Granada sings its collective memory back into life. Post-colonial palette. What the fire left behind, modern Grenadian cuisine, doesn't just taste good, it argues with you. It's bold, layered, and defiantly local. It has nothing to prove to the outside world. Take boiled cornmeal cuckoo laced with okra and lime. or saltfish souse made with lime, onion, and love. Every village has its own twist on traditional dishes, some versions spicier, others more herbal, but all unbending to foreign taste buds. Then there's fried bakes, a working-class staple that fed sugarcane cutters and now fills the bellies of schoolchildren. Add to that plantain porridge, callaloo soup, and pawpaw stew, and you begin to taste an identity that refuses reduction. Even something as commercialized as nutmeg, Granada's most famous export, is still handled by hand in local co-ops. You can walk into a market and see a woman slice a fresh pod, dry it in the sun, and tuck it into a basket. No barcode, no plastic. "Every spice you touch here," one vendor told me, "somebody's grandmother planted it with her bare hands." Disaster, diaspora, and the memory of the land, Granada is shaped by disaster. Not just natural, but political and economic. After Hurricane Ivan in 2004 and Hurricane Emily in 2005, agriculture was nearly obliterated. Nutmeg trees, some over a century old, were uprooted overnight. Families lost not only income, but history. But what followed was not surrender. It was replanting. The diaspora, scattered across New York, London, and Toronto, sent back seeds, money, and muscle. Churches became food banks. Abandoned schools became co-ops. Farmers' hands blistered again. And from that broken earth, the island taught itself to grow differently. Today, Granada is rebuilding not to replicate the past, but to reimagine it. Young farmers are reintroducing organic methods. Women are leading cocoa cooperatives. Beekeepers are restoring pollination chains destroyed by hurricanes. It's not just agriculture, it's resistance. Every fresh cocoa pod split open in the sun is a tiny rebellion against forgetting. Resistance rewritten, the legacy of Fadon. Granada's most powerful revolutionary wasn't Maurice Bishop. It was Julian Fadon, the son of a freed African woman and a French planter who led a massive slave uprising in 1795. Inspired by the Haitian Revolution, Fadon and his rebels burned plantations, freed captives, and held the island's capital hostage for over a year. British colonists called it terrorism. Locals called it a warning. Fedon's rebellion is rarely mentioned in tourist brochures. His name is barely etched in public monuments. Yet in the hills of Belvedere, where he made his stronghold, you can still see the foundation stones of his fortress, half eaten by moss but whispering with power. An elder priest told me, "Fadon didn't just fight. He showed us that the impossible could be organized." When Grenadians say, "We small but we Talawa," they speak with Fadon's bones beneath them. The ritual of oil down. It was a Saturday in Concord, and smoke curled up from a communal fire pit, surrounded by metal pots and banana leaves. Families had gathered for an oil down. Children ran barefoot. Men chopped seasoning with machetes. Women layered breadfruit and salted pigtail with coconut milk and turmeric. But before the pot was covered, something else happened. A prayer. Not Christian, not African, but something in between. "Guide the hand that stir the pot," murmured an elder woman, "and bless we belly, Lord." Everyone bowed, not to a statue or savior, but to the memory of the hands that had stirred before. Then the pot was sealed. Cooking took hours. Conversations wandered across politics, weather, memory. Someone played steel pan in the background. A young girl braided her grandmother's hair. When the pot was finally opened, steam poured out like history exhaling. Everyone ate from enamel plates with their hands. No forks, no shame. And as the sun set behind nutmeg trees, I realized this wasn't just a meal. It was a ritual of resistance disguised as family time. Memory in motion, Granadian proverbs. In Granada, wisdom is rarely shouted. It slipped into conversation like a spice. time longer than rope. You can't play mass and frayed powder. Every bush is not medicine. These aren't just sayings. They're coded survival guides. They warn against complacency, celebrate risk, and preach discernment. In a society forged by scarcity and colonialism, proverbs are the original instruction manual. Elders use them like punctuation. Children absorb them like rainwater. Even in Parliament, a minister once quoted, "Monkey know what tree to climb," to explain avoiding political scandal. The language is poetry sharpened by hardship. It's how Grenadians laugh at power, mourn their dead, and pass on the rules of a world not designed for their survival. Grenadian futurism. What comes next? In St. George's, university students debate climate justice and decolonization with the same fire as their ancestors debated Phaedon's tactics. One art student paints calypso lyrics across bus stops. Another grows mushrooms in old barrels to feed inner city families. This is Grenadian futurism, not about flying cars, but rerouting the future in ancestral memory. Grenada's biggest export may be nutmeg, but its real gift to the world is its ability to transform trauma into ritual, rupture into rhythm. Young Grenadians are reclaiming land, remixing carnival, reviving bush medicine. They're creating podcasts in Creole, planting community gardens in hurricane zones, and naming their daughters after warrior queens, no longer footnoted in textbooks. They're not waiting for permission. They're writing new codes in old tongues. The island that remembers. As I prepared to leave, I sat on a rock near Grand Etang Crater Lake, formed inside an ancient volcano that once tore through the island's center. Mist rolled over the water. A woman passed by, balancing a basket of callaloo on her head. She nodded but said nothing. In the quiet, I could feel it. Grenada is not a passive paradise. It is an island always remembering. Through food, through storms, through fire, through song. It holds its wounds close, not as scars, but as soil. It teaches not by lecture, but by living ritual. If you come here to take a selfie, you'll miss the story. But if you come ready to listen, to kitchens, to carnival, to the wind against Lepers Hill, Grenada will speak. And when it does, it doesn't whisper. It sings.